The New Testament text, which the lectionary suggests for study this morning, is from the 13th chapter of Mark. This passage of Scripture, Mark 13, is known to scholars as the Little Apocalypse. This is the passage where Jesus predicts the soon-to-come end of the world, warns us to prepare ourselves for the upcoming apocalypse, and tells us that after his death, he will reappear from the clouds and establish the kingdom of God. This is, without a doubt, one of the most confusing, difficult, and controversial passages in the Bible. I'm not going to delve into the intricacies of this text. What I am going to do is explain how it is this passage came to be in the Bible, and why I believe we should ignore it. Or at least, why we should ignore the way it has been interpreted by so many religious leaders intent on scaring people into the faith while pointing to this passage as proof positive that the second coming of Jesus is imminent. Journey with me, if you will, back in time, back to ancient Israel. The year is 70 AD. Jesus was crucified over 35 years ago. And most of the people who knew him and followed him have themselves been killed. The Roman Empire is at the peak of its power and controls all the nations from the Atlantic Ocean to Palestine and beyond. Power, however, is not easily maintained over such a wide expanse of nations with such diverse races, religions, and cultures. The Roman authorities have no particular fondness for the Jews and find their temple worship and temple sacrifices meaningless. But they have learned over the years that it is best to allow the vast array of cultures across the empire to practice their native religions. As long as they pay their taxes and remain peaceful, Rome is happy. But Rome rules with an iron hand. Any hint of sedition, of conspiracies against the Roman government are met with a quick and brutal response. For example, several decades ago, a Jewish peasant, an itinerant rabbi known as Jesus of Nazareth, had ventured from his home up in Galilee to the city of Jerusalem. Once there, he and a small group of his followers overturned the tables of the money changers at the Jewish temple. Jesus would be killed within a week. And it isn't so much that Jesus had a large following. By all accounts, after a year of traveling and preaching across the Galilean countryside, Jesus had at most 120 people who followed him and his teachings. But this was the Passover, the time when Jews from all over the known world came to Jerusalem to offer their sacrifices at the temple. The two Roman authorities in the region, Herod, who had traveled from Galilee to be present for the Passover, and Pilate, who ruled over Judah and Jerusalem, both understood that their positions depended on their maintaining the peace. Tiberius, the Roman emperor, did not deal kindly with those under his command who allowed problems to develop in the areas under their authority. And so Jesus was crucified. Crucifixion was the surest way to let everybody know the Roman government would not put up with any hint of trouble. Crucifixion was extremely slow. Death usually came only after several days. It was extremely painful and, sadly, all too common. And while death itself was unspeakably cruel, in most cases the body was left on the cross, dangling only a few feet off the ground for as long as it took for the birds and dogs to devour the body. A powerful message was sent. The people of Israel knew the price of causing trouble. Now, 35 years later, things have gotten out of control here in Israel. In the year 66, a large group of Jews began an attempt to become independent from Rome. For 4 years, Rome has tried to quiet the dissent and has now determined that the time has come to put an end to this nonsensical talk of independence once and for all. In this year of 70 AD, future Roman Emperor Titus, who is the son of the current Emperor Vespasian, enters Jerusalem with his troops, and he levels it. Jerusalem is now no more than a pile of rubble. And as for the temple, well, that is the greatest insult of all. The temple is the house of God, the actual place on earth where Yahweh resides. It is the physical home of the Creator. And Titus and his forces knock it down into a useless pile of crumbled stones. The Jews are crushed. How could this happen? How could Yahweh allow the temple to be destroyed? Some predict the end of Judaism. The religion of the Jews can exist no more, not without the temple, not without Jerusalem. But the Jews try to pull themselves together. The most important thing at this point is for all the Jewish people to set aside their differences and unite, not to battle Rome, but to save their religion. The Pharisees are the primary sect in the Jewish religion. Surely Jews can unite around the Pharisaic practice of Judaism. If not, Judaism perhaps will be no more. But there is one problem, one gigantic problem that will not go away. And that problem is this small Jewish sect that is acting as a sort of reform movement within Judaism. These people follow the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. Some have even taken to calling themselves Christians, believing that Jesus of Nazareth, the crucified one, was the Christ, the long-awaited Jewish Messiah. What nonsense. Every Jew in first century Israel knows that the Messiah will be the Jewish king who will rise up, conquer the powers of the world, and establish God's kingdom on earth. Jesus does not fit that criteria. For starters, he did not conquer Rome. For finishers, he's dead. And yet, this new movement, these Christians, just won't go away. They will not unite under the teachings of the Pharisees. And so, they are thrown out of the synagogues. They may no longer worship and study with the Jews. A benediction against heretics soon appears and says of the Christians, quote, "They shall be thrown out of the synagogues into the outer darkness, and their names shall be removed from God's book of life." Now, imagine that you are one of these Christians. The Roman authorities would just as soon kill you as look at you. Your faith tradition, the religion of all your friends, of your family, of your parents, has officially declared that you are forever beyond the reach of God's mercy because of your beliefs. And you know what is really amazing? The story of Jesus has never been put in writing. There are a number of reasons for this. For one, it seems that many of the people who knew Jesus thought he was going to return at any moment to establish God's kingdom on earth, proving he was indeed the long-awaited Messiah. There was no need to write the story down. Everybody would realize soon enough who Jesus really was. Another reason is that many of the people who have followed the teachings of Jesus over these past 35 years have been poor and illiterate. They couldn't put the story in writing if they wanted to. But for whatever reasons, Jesus has been dead for 35 years. The world seems to be falling apart all around you, and there is not even a written account of who Jesus was and of what Jesus said. All you know is what has been told to you. All you know are the stories that have been handed down verbally over the years. That is about to change. A man history will know as Mark is about to write the first account of the life, death, and teachings of Jesus. The story Mark writes will be widely disseminated. Other accounts of Jesus will be written in the near future. Two of those accounts will be written by authors that history will know as Matthew and Luke. Both of those authors, Matthew and Luke, will have a copy of Mark's story in front of them when they write their accounts of the life of Jesus. They will use Mark's story as the basic outline and add and subtract details to make the story more accurate according to the way they have heard the story told. So Mark sets out to write his story, the good news about Jesus, which will become known as the Gospel of Mark. For the most part, Mark writes the story as he has heard it. Many claim Mark heard his story from the Apostle Peter, the disciple many believe was the closest to Jesus. Mark's story begins with Jesus being baptized by John the Baptist in the Jordan River. There is no virgin birth story. There is no account of Jesus' life as a child at all. Those details will be added to the story later by Matthew and Luke. But one thing must be made clear. Mark does not attempt to write a history of Jesus. Mark is not a historian. He is an evangelist. His intended audience is Christian. He explains that the Son of God who did mighty deeds upon the earth must be followed, and that the followers of Jesus each have their own crosses to bear. He is writing to a church of martyrs, to a group of people who quite likely will be killed for believing as they do. Between the years of 200 BC and 150 AD, a genre of writing developed that was known as apocalyptic literature. In the Old Testament, the book of Daniel is the best example of apocalyptic literature. In the New Testament, Revelation, or the Revelation of John, is the best example of apocalyptic literature. Mark's gospel is not apocalyptic, with the exception of the 13th chapter. And it is known, as I said earlier, as the Little Apocalypse. What is apocalyptic literature? It is writing that is filled with symbolism and symbolic imagery that conveys the idea of an approaching cataclysmic event in which God destroys the evil ruling powers of the world and raises the righteous to life in an eternal godly kingdom. Apocalyptic literature is end-of-the-world stuff, and it is a powerful tool for those whose public voice has been quieted, for those who can only whisper their thoughts conspiratorially among themselves. As Mark writes his gospel account, he includes an apocalyptic section, which we find in the 13th chapter. Let me recap Mark 13. He first writes that Jesus looks at the temple, which is still standing in Jesus' day, of course, and predicts that the day will come when not one stone will be left upon another. Then Mark has Jesus predict that the day will soon come when there will be great wars and nations will turn against nations. And then Mark has Jesus predict that his followers will be hated by their own families, that they will be thrown out of the synagogues, and that they will be persecuted and killed by people who think that by killing Christians, they are doing God's will. And then Mark has Jesus say that soon after all these things happen, the sun will be darkened, the stars will fall from the skies, and Jesus, the Son of Man, will appear from the clouds and will send his angels to gather his followers from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heavens. And then Mark has Jesus say that no one knows the day or hour all this will come to pass, but everyone must be watchful, must keep awake, for it could occur at any moment. And you, living here in the year 70 AD, you who are hated by almost everybody who knows you because of your beliefs, you find great comfort in the words of Mark 13. And now I ask you to come back to the year 2000 because I want to tell you something I'm not supposed to tell you. I'll tell you what is taught at every reputable mainline seminary in the world. I'm not talking about those Bible college preacher mills here, but scholarly academic seminaries. This is taught, but is withheld from the people in the pews, supposedly for their own good. After all, we can't let the truth get in the way of scaring people into the faith. Here is what you are not supposed to hear. Jesus of Nazareth almost certainly did not say any of the things Mark attributes to him in the 13th chapter of his gospel. Those are the words of Mark. They are not the words of Jesus. Mark places words in the mouth of Jesus that perfectly describe the world 35 years after Jesus' death. The world Mark's community must live in, a community threatened by both the prevailing religion and by the military might of Rome. I know this bothers some people, and I do understand, but don't think any less of Jesus because of it, and don't think any less of Mark either. Remember, Mark had no intention of writing a history of the life of Jesus. His purpose was to embolden those who were facing death because of their belief in Jesus. His purpose was to remind Christians that Jesus really did conquer the evils of the world when he gave up his life at the cross. With the exception of the revelation of John, this 13th chapter of Luke has been used by more misguided preachers than any other part of Scripture to scare people, to make people worry, to make people fret over the conditions of their souls. What a crime. A crime. Please hear this. Mark did not write the 13th chapter of his gospel to scare anybody. He wrote it to give people hope, to lift their spirits, to remind those facing death that God really does overcome the evils of this world, ultimately, and that in the eyes of God and from the viewpoint of the eternal, those who are loving and faithful really do win out over those who succumb to evil. The language is symbolic and figurative, and for that reason, it is very powerful. In my final semester of seminary, I had a class called Christian Education. You should have seen the 20 or so seniors in that class arguing daily over the subject of Christian education. Before you can figure out how to educate people about the Christian message, you have to determine what the Christian message is. And we had at least 20 different opinions about that. Then, after you decide what the true Christian message is, you must decide how to convey it to your congregation. I will never forget one day as we sat there arguing over all the things we had learned in our years at seminary, especially about all the things we had learned about the Bible, how it came to be, who wrote it, how it has been changed over the years, and so on. And one of the students was lamenting the fact that most of her seminary experience had been a waste of time because you couldn't share those things you'd learned with your congregation. As we continued discussing this, I asked a simple question. Honestly, I asked, why don't we just tell people the truth? And most of the people in that class, including the professor, laughed. They laughed at the idea of telling their congregations what they knew to be true about the Bible. For the most part, some agreed that they might do that sometime if they were sick of serving a particular church and wanted to get fired. But clearly, people in the pews were not ready for the truth. In fact, people must be protected from the truth. We must be very careful not to damage people's faith. Well, I tell you now what I told them then. Faith built on falsehoods is not worth the energy it would take to flush it down the toilet where it belongs. We don't need to protect anybody from the truth. And even to insinuate such a thing, I believe, is an insult to God and an insult to our faith. Have we so little confidence in our faith that we fear having it bump up against the truth? The truth is our best friend, and a faith built on ignorance serves no good purpose. It is faith built on ignorance that insists high school science books must not contradict the creation myths we find in the Bible. Is our faith that weak? If we come to the conclusion that the creation stories in the Bible are beautiful poetic myths that point toward important eternal truths, truths about the relationship between God and the world, truths about our condition when confronted with the pure and perfect brightness of God's eternal love, if we come to that conclusion, does that mean God just goes away? Do we really need to protect God from the truth? Always remember, there is no truth to be found anywhere in the universe that can harm God, because God is always waiting for us squarely within any truth we find. This church, University Congregational Church, has a well-established and very important tradition. From this pulpit, you have always been respected, and you have always gotten the truth. I make this promise to you, that will never change. I stand here with a single motivation, to help you strengthen your faith journeys by pointing you toward a closer relationship with God. I could never do that by pointing anywhere other than directly at the truth.